Our last speaker today is Angus Catchett. He's going to give a perspective on thrips control in the Mid-South.
Hi, good morning. I'm going to kind of give a similar perspective on thrips control, but for the Mid-South region, there'll be a little bit of overlap with Dr. Roberts, but for the most part, I think they'll complement each other pretty well. And actually, I'm going to be showing y'all some fairly new data that we just got in a couple weeks ago. So when you think about seed treatments, and that's generally what we're talking about now, for the most part, as Philip mentioned earlier, in thrips control, we're using seed treatments on most of the crops that we're growing in our region, all the way from rice, corn, soybeans, wheat. So we're using them on just about everything. Now, one of the differences is when it comes to cotton is pretty much the only one that we routinely get problems with thrips pest on. And in our region, as Philip said, very similar to the Southeast, we're exclusively, for the most part, dealing with tobacco thrips. This was some survey information the Mid-South group conducted 15 years ago. It still holds true today. Tobacco thrips are predominantly the species that we deal with. As you start moving west into Texas, I think they move more into westerns. But for us, it's routinely going to be tobacco thrips, and we can see problems, and we do see problems. You know, a lot of times I hear certain people, academics, that don't really understand cotton or haven't been in our region, we'll talk about seed treatments not being really a good IPM practice. Well, I disagree completely with that notion, particularly in cotton, because I think Philip mentioned it earlier. In our region, the chances that you're going to have a problem with thrips in cotton is 100%. So it's not like you're applying a pesticide before it's needed. We know you're going to need it, and that's proven true time and time again. Now, not quite as dramatic as the Southeast, but this is 35 trials that John North, one of our graduate students, pulled together, and this is just showing Mississippi, but we do see about 100 pounds different. If you look at the whole Mid-South region in general, it's about 115, 130 pounds, and that does not seem like a lot, but I'm going to tell you, if you've had your ear kind of close to the floor right now and you're listening to what these farmers are saying, there's a lot of concern right now going into this next year, especially with commodity prices. This in and of itself could easily be the difference between being in the black or the red in 2016. So thrips are something that we definitely got to control. Philip mentioned this. In 2011, we began seeing some problems. We were pretty much, I would say, just estimating probably 90% thiamethoxam use in the Mid-South. There was a lot of cruiser Victa being used in the Mid-South region, and we started seeing some problems that year, and we've always seen some need for oversprays in our region for thrips, whether we had a seed treatment or not. But typically, we averaged about one application on somewhere between 30 and 40% of the acres, and that was always normal. It counted for all the extremes. But we jumped pretty big throughout the region, and this is just for Mississippi, but the other regions were very similar. We jumped up to a couple applications, and it was on probably 80% of the acres. In 2012, we saw the same thing. So really, as a group across the whole region, we never would have even thought about resistance and thrips because there's so many hosts and various things. We started trying to come up with all these different reasons to sort of explain it away. We were looking at pre-herbicides. I think everybody across the belt looked at pre-herbicides and interaction with thrips, and as Philip showed, there is some issues there or potential for interaction and various things. But it wasn't until a couple of years later that we really started kind of pinning down. We ruled out about everything that you could rule out that potentially we had some resistance or tolerance problems with at the time, thiamethoxam. Now, you see the big jump in 2014. That's because in 2013, we had figured this out, and we just about made a wholesale switch to imidacloprid in the state of Mississippi, and that's why it dropped back down. So we have a student, Ms. Chelsea Darnell. She's actually here. She'll be talking about this later today in the student section. So she started doing some work, and we had Syngenta and Bayer involved with Dr. Fred Musser mentioned earlier. So we kind of adopted some assays developed by Syngenta where we would go collect thrips from wild hosts, both selected and non-selective, and we're able to conduct assays and generate some LC50s or resistance ratios. So I'm just going to briefly go through that. But in 2014, with thiamethoxam, we had resistance ratios that ranged from somewhere about 6 in the Mississippi Hills to 21. Now keep in mind, in the Delta region, at these levels, we were already having field control failures at those levels. Well, what you haven't probably seen yet, and this is, like I said, this is mostly from Mississippi, this part of it, the jump, even though we were having trouble at that 21-fold or resistance ratio level, look at the difference year-to-date from 14 to 15. So it appears that it's getting more fixed and more resistant into the population. Now, one of the things that's a little different, and I'm not going to jump out there and say we have a problem yet, but I am getting worried about this a little bit. If you look at 2014 with imidacloprid, at least in our region, very similar to the lab assay when it to the lab colony when it's as far as LC50s or resistance ratios, but we did see a pretty big jump in 2015 with imidacloprid in the trials. Also, in the later planted trials, I had about 8 different trials with straight imidacloprid in it this year, and in just three or four of the later planted trials, and this may be post-selection, I was seeing some field problems with straight imidacloprid this year. We were not seeing this across the region as a whole, but we were seeing it in some grower fields and in some small plot fields. So I'm beginning to get a little bit worried about this, and that was the first, Philip, that I saw the slide that you showed from Kennedy stuff with imidacloprid a while ago. So this is something that I'm beginning to worry about a little bit, but I'm not prepared nearly at this time to say we need to make some wholesale switches, but we need to be thinking about that because some of these cottonseed varieties will have straight imidacloprid on it. So I think there is reason for concern, at least caution going forward. So Philip mentioned this. Anything that holds this cotton plant back makes it more susceptible to thrips disease. It can be a whole host of things, and that's why we went down these roads of pre-herbicides and all these different things when we started seeing the problem. But here recently, we're beginning to look at a lot more things. He mentioned this earlier. This is some new data one of our students, Whitney Crow, is working on. This is just looking at a whole bunch of different seed treatments within tilled and no-tilled environments. And regardless of the seed treatment, and this is one where we didn't get great control, this is average, but in this particular example, we were able to move the bar about 4/10 of a point by going from a reduced till to a conventional to a reduced till environment. In other words, we're able to keep it below that 3 mark, and that's sort of that magic number, as Philip mentioned, it is for us too. Now, this is one of the things we were very interested in. We really haven't just thought about a lot over the years, but there's a lot of factors that may affect the ability of a plant to uptake and take up the neonics and really just affect thrips control in general. But one of the things we were very interested in, because a lot of our soils have nematodes, reniform nematodes or root knot, in this case it was reniform nematodes, is what interaction might be going on with thrips and nematodes. Well, one of the things that jumped out immediately at us, and again, this is averaged across two different locations, we didn't really see a big difference in our above ground damage ratings in the presence of nematodes or no nematodes, and that was just simply determined by using telone or no telone. But however, if you look at that biomass, and we bought that biomass rating, and we took it 36 days after planting, which was first square for us, there seemed to be an additive effect where you had a seed treatment and telone together. So there was a difference in biomass, but it took the two things together to create that. So that was very interesting. However, when you looked at yield, nematodes was the overriding factor. The thrips control component, at least in this trial, and again, this is 1 year. I would expect this to be different in some years. But in this situation, it was the nematode control, even though there was an additive effect on biomass that outweighed it on yield. So that's something, this is a complex, there's a lot of complex interactions going on is the point I'm trying to make. Now, this is brand new. It's something we've been playing with a little bit. Our Mid-South Entomology Working Group has done a whole bunch of work looking at neonic concentrations for some pollinator work that we've been doing, you may be familiar with, looking at a lot of different neonic concentrations in corn, cotton, and soybeans, both in the soil and in the plant. Well, one of the things that we would see sometimes a lot of site-to-site variation from Stoneville to Starkville to Arkansas to Tennessee. They would be relative, but there was differences in the amount that we would see from the same seed source, same seed treatment and so forth, about how much is in the plant. And again, if you don't have much in the plant, you're not going to get control. So there was some things going on. So one of the things that Chelsea Darnell, one of our students, did this year, this is some greenhouse work, but I thought this was real interesting. She went and found three different soil types that we tested and did not have any background levels of neonics. We took a sand, a silt, and a clay. And we looked at it from the standpoint of whether we saturated the soil or just give it adequate moisture. And what we did with the saturated, we essentially watered these 8-inch pots, and it was predetermined amounts and so forth. But we watered them till we had run through 500 mils run through the pot and out the bottom. And so that's what we did. But in the saturated, so at 21 days after planting, we took three Poncho 1250 corn plants and planted, spaced them out in these pots evenly, and we had three subsamples per rep. So 21 days after planting, we took a soil sample. We sent them to the lab in Gastonia, had them analyzed. In every situation, we were able to recover more clothianidin where we had a saturated soil. So what was happening here is it was pushing this neonic throughout the soil profile. We took a soil sample. We were able to recover more. Now here's the interesting part though. We pulled those plants in that 21 day mark. That was when the corn was V3. We had the inverse on what was in the plant. So that makes sense if you think about it. What that means is where we had just adequate moisture in a lot, and this is just what I'm hypothesizing here, is where we kept those neonics around that seed where we didn't saturate and leach them into the soil profile, we were able to get a lot more uptake into those corn plants. And a lot of the stuff we pick up in the soil may or may not be available to the plant anyway. So to me, this can obviously explain some of the differences with data that we may see on site-to-site variation when it comes to rain or so forth. If you just have adequate moisture, we may be able to uptake a lot more seed treatment, therefore get a lot more control, rather than if you had a lot of rain and so forth. So this is just the very beginning of this, but it does sort of explain some of the things that we've been seeing over the years. Another thing we've been playing with that complicates this factor even more when it comes to cotton, I've been noticing sometimes in trials planted side by side, same planting date, same everything, untreated check plots that may vary from in our damage scale, which Philip showed earlier, which is essentially a 0, no damage, 5 is a dead plant, 3 is about that magic mark where we see yield. We'll see great differences from trial to trial. So one of the things that Chelsea Darnell did last year, we planted a whole bunch of just black seed varieties, and we just simply took thrips damage ratings on them. This is important to me for a couple of different reasons, particularly from an academic standpoint. There is great variation in the variety itself and its ability to withstand or tolerate thrips. This shouldn't be probably a surprise to anybody. We just haven't done it in a long time. But the problem with this is, if I got a trial and I have Phytogen 222 in my trial and say Scott Stewart has Stoneville 6448 in his, we may be getting the same level of control on a thrips treatment, and when we go to compare notes, we're going to get very different results. So this is something that I'm very, very interested in moving forward. And what you'll see is you start kind of pulling all these things that Philip talked about and that I've been talking about, when you start kind of pulling all this total package together, it seems to me that it would be pretty easy to sort of, even in light of some of the problems we're having with the neonic seed treatments today, it would be pretty easy to kind of pull in some IPM standards or some BMPs where you utilize a whole bunch of these different approaches to thrips control, similar to what we're doing with plant bugs in the Mid-South, and come up with an overall management plan for thrips that would be very beneficial to the producer and potentially save the life of some of the insecticides we're using. Now, going forward, I'm not saying these are hard, fast rules. These are things we've been talking about. Now, we haven't really recommended thiomethoxam in the Mid-South now for a couple of years since we've seen this data. Now, as far as the gaucho, I'm not prepared, or straight into the clover, I'm not prepared at this time to really stand here and say it's not a recommendation, but I'm going to tell you I'm worried about it based on what I saw last year. And if you're going to grow a cottonseed variety that has straight imidacloprid on it, I would be thinking about that going into this year. I would be thinking about it. And one of the things I would maybe suggest is simply just adding a little ornithine as a as a seed treatment on top of it, or, you know, you got foliar sprays and infers and that kind of stuff. But we've done a lot of work recently looking again at Orthene as a seed treatment over the top of a neonic, and it actually performs pretty good. It was just sort of an extra safety measure. Aris is performing really well for us. It still has. Part of the reason for that is the thiodicarb component is actually providing some thrips control as well. So there's an additive effect there. Of course, the foliar treatments, this is something we've always done, but we might need to be a little quicker pulling the trigger on some of them, knowing what you've got in the field. And we haven't adopted the infer sprays nearly to the degree the Southeast has, but it's an option for us if our growers are set up to do it. And of course, you saw yesterday in this same session that maybe the long-term solution to this, which is down the road a ways, is potentially some traits. So with that, 20 seconds left, Gus. Yes, sir. I can't hear anything you're saying. Let me ask, because I still can't hear you well, but did you say if I was to compare imidacloprid plus Orthene versus Aris, how they would stack up?
Stack up in terms of cost and convenience.
As far as cost, adding the Orthene, I'm guessing, would probably be a little bit cheap. So here's the problem with Orthene. Orthene's always been used. It's always essentially worked, but it's short-lived. In fact, the reason that it's, you know, if you remember back when we were using Timic, a lot of time, particularly in Louisiana, but in Mississippi, we would spike it with an Orthene seed treatment to get that initial kick until the Timic kicked in. So Orthene is really good, but we get about 14 days. That was always the weakness, and that's why we readily adopted the neonics. So there was definitely some benefit there, and as long as you're still getting some activity out of your neonics, it's probably a good option. But as they start going down, there's no question, I think, that the Aris would outplay it. And if you're in a nematode situation, you got more biomass, and a healthy plant is better for thrips. So, I mean, it just kind of depends on your situation. But, I like the Orthene seed treatment, but, again, it's short-lived.
Hey, everybody.
Thanks.